And gave me something called like gypsy cold remedy or something.
Like you drink it and Stevie Nicks starts singing? What happens?
What happens is it tastes like dry grass and mustard seeds and is awful.
I don't know if I would trust that.
Why do you know what dried grass tastes like?
I don't know. I eat a lot of dried grass. I eat a lot of alfalfa.
Things are different in Canada.
Mm, they really are. I guess we should get started since we have an hour.
This is PC Gamer Podcast number 366. I'm Evan Lottie, executive editor at PC Gamer. Beside me is Tyler Wilde, senior associate editor.
Hello. Happy holiday times, I guess.
Happy turkey time.
We have a little break between Thanksgiving and the next round.
We do.
It's national shopping
time.
Unless
you celebrate Hanukkah, in which case they kind of aligned. So.
Right.
Yeah. And that is Corey Banks, managing editor of PC Gamer.
Gobble, gobble.
Thank you, Corey. So we're back. We played some games over the break. That's kind of what we're going to be talking about.
Boy, did we. We played a lot. I played a lot of games.
Yeah,
I sure did. Four days off.
I saw you guys on Twitter talking about all the games you were playing.
Yeah, mostly Battlefield.
We played a lot of Battlefield. Yeah. A lot.
Didn't get an invite.
What?
Aww. Just saying.
Dude.
No, it's probably for the best. I would have been... I make a really good distraction in Battlefield. Like, I don't know if I would have necessarily helped the team out much. Every time I jumped in over the weekend, because I played like two or three times over the weekend, and it seemed like I was at my best on the map that I played. I played on a server where it was all just pistols, and it promised ultra-fast XP, which didn't really pan out for me, unfortunately.
If you want to level up your pistol, I guess.
Well, and that's exactly what happened, right? I got the award and everything. And I was actually doing not too bad. I had an even ratio with the pistol. The moment I switched over to, like, Siege of Shanghai on a normal server, it was a catastrophe. It was a horror show, honestly.
I think Battlefield is really meant to be played with pistols, but...
It's not. It was strange. Like, because I have an expectation when I play Battlefield of, like, command points and teamwork and lots of vehicles. And the first server I jumped into over the weekend was, like, a team deathmatch, everybody running around on foot
scenario. I tried team deathmatch once, and it just didn't appeal to me very much. Because, I don't know, the Conquest games are really all about positioning. You know, it's about where you are relative to the enemy, relative to control points. Are you in a group in your squad? Are you spawning on your squad? I mean, you can... If Battlefield is interesting, or four with the squad spawn, just the fact that one guy running into a point to back cap can quickly become five guys,
right? Yeah.
And that point is captured, and you can see a total, like, point or capture point takeover wipe in a matter of 30 seconds, a minute, if it's like executed well.
And it's interesting that you can do that too, because it totally throws the concept of realism out the window, right? That's such a game conceit compared to, like, here's this experience that you would have in war, right?
Yeah, I mean, they don't even have you, like, parachute down to your squad member. You just appear behind them. So, you know, I'll be sniping because I like to be a burden on my team. And, you know, I'll spot one guy, and I'm like, ooh, I'm going to get him. And then suddenly there's four guys standing there, which is exciting because every time you see a target, it's hard to find people in Battlefield sometimes. It's hard to find infantry to shoot at.
Right.
So snipers tend to just be counter snipers and stand around looking for each other's glints, which helps nobody.
Sure.
But
do they call you the eagle or like the hawk or the owl?
Do I have a cool nickname?
Yeah.
You mean
because you're always sniping.
Tyler Hawkeye Wild. I would go by Hawkeye, absolutely. And I would
We might start calling you Hawkeye.
Distill my own vodka and just make slightly inappropriate quips, but I'm really just trying to help, you know, help us get through
the war,
the horrors of war, with a little bit of humor. Right. And
you think your audience understands that you're referencing MASH at this point, or do you need to like lay it on a little thicker?
I think they do.
Okay, good.
I think they do. I think I should lay it on thicker throughout the whole.
Come
podcast.
For the video games, stay for the obscure TV references.
So
MASH isn't obscure.
So we were the beneficiaries of like a lot of people, I imagine, the double XP weekend.
Yeah, and I was combining the 25% XP boost with that. So
yeah,
I finally got the best sniper rifle. Now
cool.
I just have to.
Oh wow.
I have to get lots of kills with it so I can unlock the the scope I want and the straight pull and stuff like that.
So did it really feel like the progression was going that much faster?
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Well, it feels as if it were doubled.
Ah, I see what you did there.
I got like 7 or 8 levels in a, you know, in a session.
Oh, wow.
A level per map, basically.
Okay.
But about that, I've been sort of trying to figure out how I feel about the progression in Battlefield 4, like, and if I really consider it to be a meaningful set of progression.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know, I mean, on the surface, it does seem sort of strange to me that there are a lot of guns in Battlefield 4.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are probably, I wish I had a number in front of me, but there are probably 60, 50 guns, I don't know.
I would make up a number. I would be like,
including pistols, including launchers and stuff like that?
Probably 147 guns.
Wonderful. Because there are something like 9 assault rifles or something, and like 8 LMGs or and sniper rifles, probably a comparable amount,
mm-hmm.
I'm trying to figure out if there are really meaningful differences between those guns rather than, I mean, for example, all the assault rifles do the exact same amount of damage.
Yeah, I can't speak for any of the other guns because I've only unlocked sniper rifles, but strangely, you start out with one of the best, or I did. And then
that's intentional.
There were 3 or so that I unlocked that I didn't want to use, and it's really like you said, the damage is the same. Like, comparing them, yeah, a lot of them, like, the unlocked ones would have their attributes would be slightly worse than the one I already had, so I didn't understand why I would even bother trying it.
With your upgrades and things like that.
Yeah, or and also you unlock attachments by using a gun. But when you get up, there's like maybe 3 after the first one. You can start unlocking ones, and the only difference, same damage, same clip size, the only difference is range, and there is a very noticeable difference when you get a sniper rifle with better range, because there's less bullet drop.
Yeah.
So I don't have to compensate for range as much. But because I still have to compensate for it, it's like now I just have to learn to, aim above a little less. So I'm still having to learn a different gun, a different skill. So I don't know that it actually helps.
It sounds
helps
a little bit like a fake metric of completion.
It doesn't necessarily help me a lot when I've been using this gun the whole game, where the bullet drops a lot.
Yeah.
And then the bullet drops not as much with the new gun, and now I have to adjust and unlearn what I'd learned.
You spent all this time learning how to use the first gun in the first place.
I guess the conclusion I'm sort of coming to with Battlefield 4 is not that it's like an outright bad system or even an outright system that I don't like. I do think it's very spread out. It's meant to sort of give you the feeling that you're getting lots of stuff.
Right.
Especially through the battle pack system,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, whatever, it's a booster pack thing. You're basically unlocking a booster pack. It's sort of a weird way to package things. But, I mean, most, like, LMGs and assault rifles and everything else, like all of them, for example, have a suppressor and a potato grip, every single one of them. And therefore, they're all very symmetrical, I think. It's like, mm-hmm. I'm unlocking the same set of attachments for every assault rifle. And the differences between the assault rifles are basically instability and accuracy, you know, with a little bit of variance there. And it's in, like, how they distribute bullets and rate of fire and things like that. And those are important differences.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of, you're going to find the one that suits you as a player in terms of, you know, do you lie prone? Do you run and gun and things like that? Do you want something that's all around or something that's more range-based? And those are important differences, but they're very, very subtle.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not like Counter-Strike where it's like the AK can kill you in one shot in the head and the M4 cannot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a significant, like, apples and oranges kind of, which side are you on? Do you like the heavy hitting, less accurate, like slightly slower firing AK? Or do you like, you know, the fast, slightly faster firing, lighter, slightly more accurate M4? And that's, like, for Counter-Strike players, you're kind of on one side on that. You know, you have, like, you know, you learn to play with both, but it's like those guns have this embedded, like, personality.
You end up leaning towards one or the other, and it defines the kind of Counter-Strike player that you are.
Sure.
Whereas the 147 different handguns you can use in Battlefield 4 are not going to do that.
Yeah, I'm generalizing. I mean, there's like a really cool revolver, just to sort of pick on the handguns that I've been using. That is like really slow, heavy. I can kill a guy in 2 shots, sometimes 1.
And it feels distinctly
and that's
different
fun.
Than,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, I love using the handgun, but I haven't unlocked any new ones. But.
Mm-hmm.
As a sniper, I kind of have to, so I'm hoping to get that one.
Yeah, I also don't like, I do feel pretty discouraged from playing Recon, which I play the least of. I'm pretty much, you know, 90% of my time is an engineer or assault.
Yeah,
I'm definitely
all engineer.
I'm finding my role as Recon. I joke about being a burden to the team, but I'm usually in the top, you know, 5 to 10 players as far as capturing points.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I spend a lot of time spotting. And I think really the what defines you as a player of a class is not the gun based on the sort of, the progression of that, but the gadgets you choose. There's significant difference, you know, if you want to be a recon with maybe instead of a sniper rifle using a shotgun, using C4, mm-hmm. running up to vehicles, laying traps, or do you want to be a spotter, which I am doing a lot of. It's super important, actually, to
spot.
I
think it's hugely valuable.
Yeah, because when you're in a helicopter and you're moving around, it's really hard to find targets. So, hey, I can be useful that way. And then I try to shoot them from really far away, because that's what I like to do.
Now, this is a noob question, but the gadgets and stuff that you can unlock, are those on a separate progression tree from all the weapons? Like, do you have to use C4 a certain number of times to get?
No, it's just your...
They're in a certain order, basically.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, those are pretty significant. I don't know.
They are. I agree.
Assault or whatever. Getting the med kit is a totally different way to play. Mm-hmm.
It's just a different way of looking at the class instead of focusing just on the gun.
And engineers, of course, you know, you like the slam.
I love the slam. Mm-hmm. I wish I could break out that acronym. Oh, I'm so ashamed. Last word is mine. the M2 slam mine is it's like a lighter weight AT mine that you can throw a little bit further than the heavier, like, disc-shaped AT mine, and you can also float in water and things like that.
Ooh.
But the cool thing is it persists between deaths. So I'll put two at this point on, like, capture point C, where I know there's a lot of tank traffic, and, like, two deaths later, I will get the notification that I destroyed or disabled a vehicle. I'm like, oh, cool. And that's just an amazing feeling of, like, surprise points and kills, you know?
It's a nice level
in
of,
any
like,
context.
World or map permanence, too. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, I like that. And the game, at least at this point, doesn't feel saturated with them either. I mean, it doesn't feel like an imbalanced thing. I've definitely died from them and been like, oh, where did that come from? I didn't see those, but it's a fair game. It's a big map.
Have they fixed the one-shot kill bug yet?
So that patch, there's an article on our site about that. If you are wondering what we're talking about with this one-shot kill, where there's basically within 8 meters, I think, is the mm-hmm. distance, basically headshots, and they're not sure if it's the hitbox or the netcode or some combination or whatever. Within 8 meters, headshots were doing 100% more damage. So instead of like 50, which would not kill you, that would just halfway kill you with a gun, say gun A, it would kill you.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if you've been playing Battlefield 4, you've almost definitely experienced this, you know, in corridors and things like that, where you're just like, wow, that was fast. Or, wow, I killed that guy. Yeah, it's happened to me a bunch. That's supposed to be fixed in a patch this week, along with a few other things. They didn't mention in their pre-release patch notes, though, the crashes, which are, you know, ultimately it's really not. I haven't been getting a lot of all my crashes over the double XP weekend have been through during the loading screens, like between matches and not during matches. So personally, I'm like whatever. I just you know,
keep your points.
Yeah. I mean, that's the main thing. That was happening at launch, which was really disastrous.
Oh, yeah. Every two or three matches at launch, I would crash out of and lose my progression. I didn't have any crashes, I think. No, I might have had one loading screen, but other than that, it was really smooth over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I'm having a lot of fun. Battlefield, the matches are about, what, half an hour if the teams are evenly matched?
Yeah, it depends on the number of tickets in the server.
Which is great because it gives the match a lot of time to sort of develop its own personality, its own rhythm, its own story. But sometimes you'll have that match that just nothing is going right, and that can be a really disheartening 30 minutes.
Mm. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, you just by nature of the skill of the game, you're one of 32 players if you're playing at max size, or one of, you know, 24 at like medium size. You don't have a lot of control. You know, if your team is losing, you can only do so much to influence that. If you're in a squad, I think you can do a lot more to influence that.
Yeah, as a squad, we, like, I think, single-handedly won some of the matches we were in.
It makes a huge difference to be able to say to the guy behind you as you die, like, there's a guy to the right that just shot me with his gun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, be ready for that, or put a grenade in there or something. Yeah, huge difference. What's your favorite map so far, Tyler?
Well, when I started, it was Paracel Storm, just because I like boats. Boats are fun. and I like air maps, and I've been playing around with the Warthog, the jet that has the I don't know, the like underside cannon. Mm-hmm. Or actually no, rockets.
Yeah, A-10 Warthog.
Yeah.
It's a tank killer.
So It's fun killing tanks, except for if anyone at all on the other team is any good at flying a jet, they can take you down real quick.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it might be Rogue Transmission now.
Mm.
I just like the openness of the map. I like... Well, as someone who likes sniping, I like that there are lots of places where I can see the entire map. And, yeah, I really like the central satellite dish. It's kind of interesting to have people running across that, especially when you can't hit them, but you can see their little ant-like silhouettes, and you can kind of tell how many people are going to dive down into that little toilet bowl.
Yeah, it's a big dangerous... I mean, you're super exposed up there for anyone who's sniping those towers.
And it's a really, really, really challenging, like, ground vehicle map. Trying to play infantry on that map is tough. There are a lot of anti-personnel vehicles. There's the rocket launcher, I think, is on that map.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a huge choke point at D for Slam Mine and other AT to kind of congregate and slow people down. So, yeah, it's interesting. It's sort of U-shaped like a lot of other battlefield maps, but it has that sort of, in terms of the road travel and vehicles, a choke point there.
I think my least favorite right now, which used to be Operation Locker, but I have found some value in it.
Yeah.
The silliness of like getting 20 guys on one side of a door with 20 guys on the other side can be fun. I think my least favorite right now is the resort.
Hainan
Resort.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a U-shape. It's smaller than all the other maps. And I don't know, it just kind of becomes very predictable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every map usually C is the most contested point. But in that one, I feel like it's just a constant war for C and then back capping, and then you run backwards, and then everyone runs back to C, and five guys stand on the roof of C. And the boats are largely ignored.
Yeah,
for some reason.
I very rarely see boats creeping like toward A or E. Yeah.
So like it's a map with water elements that don't really work in the map. No one uses them.
As far as I can tell, boats basically just go to D and cap that and move on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. I really like the aesthetic of that map.
It's pretty.
It's definitely, you can see DICE responding to some of the criticism they got. People were modding BF3, if you remember that, to make it more colorful.
Yeah, because they had that filter on it.
To reduce this, to increase the saturation.
Get rid of the blue filter. It.
Yeah, yeah. I like Zavod. Zavod?
I like it a lot, too. It's probably the dullest looking map, but those two sort of sister buildings in the center are interesting, having two points that close to each other.
Yeah, there's some cool, there's just like some nice layering happened there where there are people on the roofs, there are people like underneath that can sort of be protected from the people on the roofs on C&D there. There's the pipe network in there that's, you can sometimes get shots through there or grenades through there, but it's not perfect. And, it's rectangular, which I think is unique to the rest of the maps in BF4. Yeah. It has a pretty clear front line, although helicopters can disrupt that very easily.
And there's a lot of opportunities to flank on the sort of right and left strips of sort of grassland.
Yep.
Yeah. That makes it pretty interesting. I spent a whole like round there just kind of to the right of D, just sort of hiding out in the rocks and the grass and stuff. And I got probably like, 20 kills from that one spot on one life, which was cool. I felt useful. Yay.
Anyway, maps.
Maps. Yeah.
Battlefield 4.
I mean, like you said in your review, the maps are the star. It's the
whole point.
They all have their own personality, and I finally warmed up a little bit to Operation Locker.
Yeah.
It's so awful.
There's something to be said for a game in which the vehicles really allow you to, just jump into an enemy's base usually and just cap that, as people drift away from there and make the assumption that it's secure. There's something to be said for, I've had several matches now, I think with you in a couple of them, where they're just clear stalemates, front lines, just people dying left and right, like trying to put bodies on top of bodies who can gain an extra foot in the hallway.
I mean, it would be really interesting to see them try out a mode, and it would have to be rectangular maps that works like it does in Rising Storm or Red Orchestra 2, where you cap in order. One team defends, one team attacks.
Well, that's rush mode.
Oh, right. They have rush mode.
Yeah.
I don't feel like... Does it work exactly the same?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, I mean,
I played a couple rounds.
I think the difference is the scale. The scale is smaller. You cannot play 64-player Rush, as far as I'm concerned. Mm. The maps are, I mean, like the there's the Rush equivalent of Golmud Railway, is basically like A, B, and C. Like you're moving in that direction, and C has two capture points, B has two capture points, A. So you're just like. In that little central part of the map, you're just moving north, basically, as an attacker, I think.
I'll have to play more of that, then.
I like it a lot. I mean, it's very focused. It's more about, I don't know, it feels really much more tactical, I'd say.
Well, because like
it's all infantry as well. Yeah.
Oh, see, I would like to see it with vehicles, jeez. Because like you said, there's this thing where...
Oh, it's not all infantry. I'm sorry. I think there's no air vehicles.
That would make sense.
Maybe no jets. I can't remember.
But, yeah jets would be hard to use, I guess. Yeah, that would be interesting, because like you said, in regular Conquest, there's a lot of sort of driving up to a point, waiting for the timer on the capture to finish, and then driving to the next point. There's not a whole... I really enjoy defending, you know, and there's not a whole lot. I mean, there's reason to, but if you're alone and everyone else has moved on to get points, you're just sitting there waiting to die. Like, you almost just have to let the enemy capture it and then go and recapture it.
I mean, the perfect example of that, and the point system honestly incentivizes that. There are not, you don't really get a lot of points for defending. You get some, but...
But if you're defending a point that just the enemy has decided that isn't a priority, you can end up sitting there alone for...
Exactly.
For quite a while.
And I think C, you know, the capture point underneath the radar dish on Rogue Transmission is a great example of that, where... It's an interesting capture point on its own. Like it's has some interesting buildings, and the composition is pretty good in terms of that. But there's kind of no reason to be there unless it's being captured or you're
you're kind of better off at E, which overlooks C.
Like sitting there, you can kind of see a portion of E. Like you can kind of see up the hill, but there's nothing you can really interact with.
Yeah,
you know you can't really defend or influence the other capture points. So.
Yeah.
They're just isolated.
On some maps, they've tried to put, like, stationary machine guns up, but those are useless.
It's an invitation to be shot, basically.
It's an invitation to be shot, and just...
Yeah.
There's so much cover and stuff in the way, like, you really need mobility.
Battlefield's just not really a defensive game. Like...
Yeah, I agree.
Just in the design spec. Like, it's built to be aggressive. Mm-hmm. So, I totally get why it's harder to defend a lot of those areas.
Yeah. I would be interested in you know, maybe this is why I should play Rushmore. Rushmore. I'm going to make some Wes Anderson jokes now. Move on from MASH. but yeah, I'd be interested in seeing some more defensive, you know, maybe in the future DLC. Some, I don't know. I don't know what design would. I think definitely in Operation Locker, one of the reasons I decided I like it a little more is because there is reason to spend the whole game in C if you own it and defend it.
Yeah. Yeah,
You can let other squads go capture the points in front of or behind it, but you kind of always need someone in C, or else it'll be taken. And once it's taken, it's that central point is so critical.
You should take a look at obliteration mode as well. It's probably not going to work for you as a sniper, but it's basically a football mode where the football is a bomb, and there's only one football bomb.
Right,
football.
So it's constantly dropping.
Exactly, and I think whoever's carrying it is shown on your HUD.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's something that they try that has some defensive elements in it. Ooh. Anywho.
I'll try this out.
That's Battlefield. We put, you know, cumulatively dozens of hours into it over the weekend.
Yeah.
Corey, what did you play?
I am still desperately attached and addicted to Hearthstone. Like, every time I tried to move away to something else, in fact, I would blame Hearthstone for the reason why I only really got 90 minutes or so into Assassin's Creed 4. Because every time I would try to play Assassin's Creed, full disclosure, I've never played a lot of any of the Assassin's Creed games.
Oh, me neither. Yeah.
I played a little bit of, like, 2, but very, very little. And everybody talks about how great 4 is. We have a really great review up on the site. But it doesn't do a lot of, especially in the very early game, it doesn't do a lot of like hand-holding or explaining why you need to care. So I've actually been kind of bored by that first scenario where you get through the tutorial and then you get into Havana and you have to do sort of the standard Assassin's Creed sneaking up on people, assassinating them. The game assumes that you know how to kill people, right? Because it assumes that you've played the previous four games or whatever.
There's a bit of tutorial.
Not a lot, and not anything that, like, certainly not anything that really ties you into the story if you're not familiar with the rest.
They kind of have you run around, like, assassinating fake, like, little guard dummies and stuff.
Yeah.
You are a pirate.
Yeah, well, so that's apparently where everything really opens up. The moment, and it's like 2 hours or so in, the moment you get your first ship, and it starts walking you through those systems, that's when everything kind of clicks, and I keep not getting to that point because it's easier for me to play a game of Hearthstone or five games of Hearthstone or spend $20 on cards in a closed beta for Hearthstone.
You know, I wrote about this in the magazine that's about to come out to subscribers that I'm increasingly concerned with how quickly a game boots and just how easy it is to sort of get in and out of. Not even necessarily like, I guess like the match time is sort of something to take into account, but how easy it is to come and go from.
Right.
XCOM is a great example. I can play one mission. I can just work on my base. I can step away. Nuclear Throne is another cool game from Vlambeer.
Mm-hmm.
They did Super Crate Box, Swedish indie developer, and that game boots. I'm like in game from Steam in I counted 11 seconds shooting stuff, and it's a roguelike, so of course it's very disposable,
right?
But yeah, like
it's that level of commitment that you are like. Well, maybe commitment is not the right word because there are going to be times where you want to sit down and devote 3 to 4 hours to a game, right? But there are also times when you want to play a game for like 20 minutes before you go and get something to eat. And being able to jump into those games.
Assassin's Creed isn't a great game to sit down with for 20 minutes.
No.
You could get through a mission in 20 minutes, but, you're being strung along. The intent of the game, I think, is to keep you going, keep you interested, keep you moving forward. It doesn't have, there's no delineation, really, like XCOM or something between a mission and then go back to home base, do another mission. At least not at first. Assassin's Creed games, in the ones I've played, have this terrible habit of trying their best to turn you off of them in the first 2 hours.
Sure.
Because
I've heard this a lot.
4 starts with you want to do some tailing missions? That sounds fun. Do you want to
do everything but stab this guy?
Yeah.
Do you want to keep someone within a certain number of meters?
Oh, gosh. Which is not fun ever.
Which just those, I understand sort of why they put those challenges in there early to get you familiar with how to navigate the world and everything, but those aren't very fun challenges.
Sure.
I do like that the missions have, and they have previous, in order to like get 100% sync, you have sort of secondary goals.
Mm-hmm.
I like that because the game's not particularly hard so far, but when you impose challenges on yourself, like never enter combat during this mission and get 3 stealth kills, that kind of stuff is fun. Just the kind of self-imposed stuff that I would probably be doing anyway, but
the
that I get
mastery stuff
that I get rewarded for it is
cool.
But
again, you're familiar enough with Assassin's Creed where you understand that additional level of stuff. Like, I don't even know why I care about the unnamed dude in the real world. Spoilers. Who is going through these memories of Edward? Right?
Well, I don't think you need to know. They kind of reset.
I view Assassin's Creed as kind of like a narrative based game, and maybe I'm going about it the wrong way, but like it hasn't given me anything about either side of its narrative in admittedly the very early stages of the game to get its hooks into me.
I
assume that at some point it will, and then suddenly I'll be locked
in. I'm sure it will. I had kind of a different reaction. I mean, I like the protagonist. He's an opportunist, a pirate, kind of a jerk. Who's
totes a jerk.
Who's assuming other people's identity and killing folk. And hey, I don't know, I
left
like that.
His fiance to just go get more money.
It feels very different, from the sort of duty-bound assassin guys.
Lose that zero and get yourself a hero, lady. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm
interested in seeing where his story goes.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've had to fill out a lot of the details by, like, reading stuff online about previous games and getting a sense of like how things may or may not be connected. But it's just that level of hook that I haven't found yet. That said, I want to keep trying because it is a gorgeous game and it is a game that clearly has a lot of interesting systems going on with it. So
I mean, I haven't even gotten really to the point where, I mean, I probably played less than you because I was so much Battlefield, but, you know, from what I understand and from what I can imagine based on seeing the game so far, once I have my ship full, you know, and, I mean, I have the ship, but once I'm upgrading it and building a fleet and recruiting people, like, that's the kind of thing that'll probably sink its hooks into me, like, the idea of, like, getting money, getting more stuff to do more stuff.
Yeah.
But anyway,
the ship combat is supposed to be fantastic.
It's pretty fun.
Hearthstone.
I mean, I'm real quick on Assassin's Creed. Actually, I was saying this to someone yesterday as we were playing Risk Legacy actually, and I was like, yeah, they were talking about Assassin's Creed 4. I was like, yeah, I've never really played those games because I feel like this is sort of where I ended up. I feel like a lot of Ubisoft games are over designed, and what I mean by that is there are too many features, they're too bloated, there are too many like side questy things that just kind of detract from the feeling of discovering things on your own.
I can totally see that.
Compare Splinter Cell, the modern modern Splinter Cells, most recent ones, like the execution system in that game a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. Was it called Extraction or something? I don't know. To Hitman, which is like, here you are, like, figure it out. Yeah. You know, no training wheels, do what you want. And think, you know, I think about like the, I forget what they're called, but this, like the tribal quests in Far Cry 3,
right?
That are like these, like, go over here and kill this animal and bring it back.
Yeah,
like,
I was going to say Far Cry 3 would be my prime example of over-designing.
Sure.
Like, that game does
the
not...
The hang glider and...
It's emblematic of a lot
of... Off.
It's emblematic of a lot of modern Ubisoft design where they're just grafting things onto it. I mean, you even see some of this in, like, Rayman Legends, which is a game that on the face of it should not be a complicated game at all.
Totally. So my question is... You know, with that as my criticism, is AC4, does it feel over-designed to you? Does it feel, I mean, you're still in an early stage, but does it feel kind of like,
you know,
bloated?
Over-designed would indicate that I, like, have
something that was
some
designed by 1,000
sense.
People, which it was allegedly.
Yeah, well, I mean, it feels complicated from the get-go. It feels like it's definitely putting a lot of systems together, but I approached it from the line of thinking that says, if I had played Assassin's Creed 1, 2, 3, Brotherhood, that I'd be familiar with how a lot of those systems work, and it wouldn't be as overwhelming. Could be that I'm wrong about that, and that no, actually, is just system graft, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't know. I did play Brotherhood, but it certainly wasn't too overwhelming for me. I mean, I already understand the free running works and how the climbing and the. And the killing, the fighting is very simple. I kind of actually wish it was more complicated.
It was the stealth that set me, like, right at the very beginning.
It's a very simplified stealth system.
It's simplified, and it also didn't make a lot of logical
sense. Either you're
sense
hiding
to
or
me.
You're not is basically
yeah.
is binary.
Or, like, you would think that you are hiding. First off, you're stealth implies that there would be something, like shadows to hide in, but apparently if I just lay down on my belly in the tall grass, nobody's ever going to see me, even though there I am.
You're using...
You're making some leaps.
Very clear cover areas,
yeah.
And line of sight and your distance from a target, and that's basically the three things you consider. So yeah, that's not really a high point for me in the game.
Yeah, coming off of something even like Batman Arkham Origins, which, like, yeah, it also kind of has a gamey stealth sort of system, but at least it was like, I understand, like, when people can't see me.
But I would say, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily call it over-designed because, I mean, like I said, the stealth is pretty simple. The fighting is very simple. It's attack, combo, parry, basically press the button when they turn red to counter. But you're in it to be pulled along by the story and meet new characters. That's, I mean,
yeah.
You are less in it, and you're in it to kind of explore freely some really cool-looking cities and sail a boat around. A ship, I'm sorry. It's not a boat. Yeah, that's what you have to be in it for, I think, at least at first. From what I understand, and I haven't played this far, like, when you really get to, like, building a fleet and sort of being an awesome pirate leader, there is
that
a whole metagame and
that has to be a lot of system craft at that point.
That yeah.
There's no way around that. So I don't know. I'm calling it that you're both right.
That's fine.
Yeah. No, I look forward to continue playing it. I definitely want to develop a better opinion about it, a more complete opinion. Because like I said, I haven't played very much yet. Too much Battlefield and too much Hearthstone for you.
So tell me why I should play Hearthstone. Hearthstone, because I don't know. Looking at screenshots and video, I don't know. I don't know why this matters to me in a card game, but the art just kind of like, it's like hyper colorful WoW art. And that's something I object to, honestly. It's like,
WoW art if you don't like WoW art. And there's, you know, frankly, there's a buy-in here from the get-go, which is that, you know, they're selling a card game, a fake card game to World of Warcraft fans. So if you already like World of Warcraft, it's much easier for you to buy into this. Did you ever play a lot? Like, everybody compares this to stuff like Magic or Scrolls. Did you ever play Dominion?
Oh, yeah.
The card game Dominion?
Yeah.
It feels as...
It's the deck-building game.
Yes, the deck-building game. Yes. The deck-building without having to spend a crazy ton amount of money on...
Yeah,
like,
totally. I've got some expansions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what I loved about Dominion, the tabletop game, is its aggressiveness, right? Its aggressiveness and its attention to what you have in your deck and how everything is going to, like, the way that those puzzle pieces are going to play out, much more so than even in Magic. And that's because everybody, you kind of already know what everybody is playing with in terms of the cards available. And you don't have that with Hearthstone, but the aggressiveness in particular is really important here because these games go fast. They're not, you don't get locked into like a standstill with someone where finally everybody, I've only had one game where both sides have run out of cards and it's just a matter of who's going to lose all of their hit points at the end, because when you don't have a card, you lose hit points. That's only ever happened once and it was the most boring game I've played. Everything else has just been fast. Get in, get out.
They're snappy.
There's little incentive, or what's the way I want to phrase this? There's nothing that really keeps you from feeling bad about losing, like, which some people hear that and think that there's no consequences, but when you lose, you're at least learning something about how another player's deck works, how some of those cards are reacting. You're learning something about the way your deck is reacting and how you've built it, and the Hearthstone's UI makes it really easy to go in and customize decks or start new decks, that sort of thing, which I've spent a lot of time doing. I'm into it because it's fast. that's really the best way of putting it.
Okay.
Like, there is an immediacy to it, like an instant reward of whether I'm winning or I'm losing. And watching how a well-made deck interacts and plays off the cards that you're drawing, like, sometimes that can be magical, just the way that system builds upon itself.
Yeah.
So it would be, saying all of that, like, it would be tough to tell someone that they should get into Hearthstone when the game opens up and spend a lot of money and buy a whole lot of cards, because I'm not convinced that you need to do that. Like, I bought some cards just because I was curious and wanted to see what would happen, but the game actually makes it really easy to unlock. You know, you're on the slower path for sure, but you'll earn enough in-game gold to buy packs and start getting some interesting cards. I'm really also into how the game sets up the feeling of playing against the AI instead of the players, which I often use that for practice, especially if I'm testing out decks. And it doesn't feel completely dumbed down, but it definitely feels like I'm testing out a deck. I'm testing my system's optimization, which doesn't appeal to everybody, but it really appeals to me.
Cool.
I don't think this is going to sell anybody on, like, if you don't like collectible card games to begin with, of which you have a few options now in the PC space.
Yeah.
I wasn't really into Scrolls. I've never been super into Magic. I've played, you know, some of it. I definitely prefer the digital versions to, like, the actual card game. Mm-hmm. But something about Hearthstone just makes it feel way more immediate. And
I'm sold enough to try it out.
Yeah.
When you said, like, testing your system optimization, that was the hook I needed.
Really?
Yeah, I like that idea. I mean, I like building systems, building sort of a machine that is going to spit out some kind of tactical advantage.
That's,
you know,
that's 100% what you're doing in this. And the level of customization that you can provide to it between having a class that you're choosing, and then as you're building your deck, you have some class-specific cards, but then you also have, you know, neutral cards that you can drop in. Like, there's lots of combinations. Assuming you guys haven't played much of it yet, like, if you start playing, it's really interesting to go and read some of the pre-built decks that some of the community has put together.
Yeah.
Not even because you want to replicate those, but just to get a sense of how they're hoping their card management plays out.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So I want to talk about XCOM before we get out of here, because attached to this podcast is an interview you did, Corey.
Right, with Ananda Gupta, who is the lead designer on XCOM Enemy Within over at Firaxis. And we talked a lot about kind of the decisions that influenced what they wanted to do with Enemy Within, and specifically how they were going for, how Ananda was going for a Cold War vibe.
Huh.
So it's a really interesting chat. But before we get into that,
that's interesting,
because I think we all have played a lot of XCOM at this point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is it still holding your attention like it's holding mine?
It is. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's... I'm starting to reach that point where, okay, so I'm putting my cards down here, and I'm not playing on Iron Man, which is gravely disappointing to me.
Okay,
I started like 5 Iron Man games, and I just got crushed, and I'm like, I don't have time for this.
Right.
So I'm playing on classic standard, basically, with some other second wave modifications, and but I'm getting to the point where it's getting easier, and I'm like, oh no, this is not what I wanted.
Yeah, it's something I mentioned. But maybe didn't go into enough in the review, but you do get to a point where, especially if you're not on Iron Man,
yeah,
where some of your upgraded soldiers are just so damn powerful.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's one thing that I'm sort of not crazy about, but the new maps are wonderful. I've just played the dock mission, which I won't spoil, but has like some very interesting, like, has a very interesting sort of very board gamey subsystem to it, where you're getting chased out of the level, basically.
Yeah,
and that was super fun to just be asked to do that. And
it was such a nice change in dynamic.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And I think I am also starting to reach the point where, you know, the 40 something hours I put in my campaign even a year ago is sort of influencing how old the like standard abduction missions can feel.
Right.
I love the new maps. I think the new maps add a whole lot. I mean, there are 50% new maps, I believe.
Something like that.
But I'm just sort of like, oh, another abduction mission came up. Like I came up right before I went to bed last night. I was like, I'm just not going to play it right now.
They started to feel so routine. I know. And one of the best additions.
There's going to be 2 mech toys. There's going to be a couple mutons. Yeah. And like, I'm going to lose a guy. And there we go.
It was always that point, like after you'd been through everything in Enemy Unknown, it was always that point where a lot of the missions started to feel like they were on autopilot. Like,
yeah.
And you'd start taking bigger risks with your shots. Maybe you would take a shot at 40% instead of like 50. Right, because you just wanted to see what would happen, and you're just pushing through those. I've had that less in Enemy Within, but that's also because I haven't totally made it over that hump, the hump that you're talking about, Tyler, where things start getting easier.
Mm.
So I've been through the dock mission.
Cool,
it's a tough mission. I like it.
I lost three of my 5 soldiers.
Oh no,
that'll happen.
It did not go well for reasons that I can't go into without spoiling. But at that point, I decided that I needed to start again. So I'm actually on my 3rd game, and I'm only playing
Iron
on
Man?
Normal Iron Man. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always have to have Iron Man on because it's that permanence of death is super.
You have to stop yourself.
Yeah. But I'm playing on normal, right? I've never finished a classic game. I still find
normal
classic
is
really
pretty
tough.
Hard starting out.
Yeah, and Ananda and I talk about like the why the beginning is so much harder, and the sheer number of choices that you have to go after at the beginning, like how that affects the gameplay.
It's mostly because all your soldiers are the same. I mean, they don't have any synergy. You can't suppress someone to add 10 aim to shots that follow it. You can't use the flush shot to trigger an overwatch and things like that. You know,
everyone's too basic.
Everyone's just taking shots.
I still strongly believe that things escalate so much more quickly in Enemy Within.
That could be.
The moment when you first meet the mutons, for example, feels like it happens a lot earlier.
I think it does. I remember feeling surprised. I was like, oh, a muton?
Yeah.
Like over the weekend, I was like, oh,
like 4 missions in. Really?
Oh, I mean, I'll take it. I mean, I had laser weapons and carapace, and I was ready for it and everything. But
I'm still really into it. I imagine the moment I hit that point, Tyler, where things start feeling easier.
Well, because you're playing Iron Man, there's the possibility it'll take you longer to hit that point because you might be losing experienced soldiers.
Yeah.
For the sake of my first playthrough of it, because I needed to get through it, I didn't play Iron Man. Uh-huh. And the fact that I could go, I didn't want him to die, reload, which is not something I like doing. I feel terribly guilty doing. Right. But when the option is there, that's why Iron Man has to exist. If the option is there, it's too tempting. But when you do that and you get a bunch of high-level soldiers sort of into the late mid-game to end-game, they're just super powerful. You've given them gene mods, or you've put them in mech suits. And
what really shakes things up, too, is if you turn on that second wave mutator where you're getting the random stats on the guys.
Yeah, I've got that.
Wow. Yeah. Does that make a difference?
Sure does. I like having more variance in my soldiers. I mean, if they're all kind of symmetrical, it makes it harder to assign them a personality.
Right.
I had an interesting thing crop up where I noticed that two of my Russian lady soldiers had the same last name. And I was like, oh, wow, so they're sisters.
Yeah.
They are. And I'll give them, like, complimentary, like, yin-yang cross call signs or something.
Sure.
You know, that was just a funny thing that cropped up. Real quickly, I'm curious if you guys, if you think Exalt is too easy, those encounters. Because I've never lost a soldier in an
really?
Exalt battle.
I felt the first one I encountered was pretty tough with the soldiers I had. I mean, just because there were a lot of them. I feel they do some stuff that kind of makes them easier tactically. They do a lot of,
like,
repositioning and retreating.
Why do they reload?
that often seems like a poor
strange.
Choice.
And they'll do that at positions where they have an opportune shot, and they'll decide to reposition. And
they'll
I'm
do
like,
that as their first action in the battle for me. Which really
and at first I would go, you know, I would breathe out and go, "Whoo, I got lucky there." But yeah, they do that too much. But the first few encounters I had with them were tough. I lost a guy.
The hacking or not the hacking mission. The is it transcoder transceiver
where you
mission?
Have to defend the transcoder.
Yeah, where you and I don't know if this happened for you guys as you were playing through it or if you've done this part yet.
Yeah, I'm sure I have.
But I just got swarmed by Exalt soldiers.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
It didn't even matter if
there
they
a lot
were
of
smarter.
Them.
There were just so many that they just completely overwhelmed me.
I find XCOM the difficulty experience between players and playthroughs really interesting. Because I've talked to people, like I was talking to Dan Stapleton a while back, our old reviews editor, who's at IGN, and he's like, oh, yeah, you know, I was playing on Classic, it just got way too easy. And I'm like, yeah, only you would call XCOM easy. But every time I talk to someone else, you know, I get a different impression of what they found was hard and what they found was too easy. Like, I found Exalt hard, you found it easy. And it might just be the way those missions happen to go for us, or what you invested research in versus I did.
Oh, totally.
There are so many factors that can make a mission go well. And one of those factors is a dice roll. So it's kind of hard to say sometimes. But I think there is a general consensus that it can get a little easy when you've got a lot of gene mods in place.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that being said, I want that sort of be our overarching sentiment about the game. I think your review sums up our feelings really well.
It's great.
In terms of the moment-to-moment stuff, I'm still having, like, total teeth gritting, like, oh my gosh, that soldier's down to 1 HP. Thank goodness. Oh my gosh, they went incapacitated instead of dying. I'm making 40% shots that I absolutely have to make and just raising my hands in the air. Like,
yeah.
That's all there, you know, and I'm really glad that the expansion is just creating more of those moments. So, yeah, stick around and listen to Corey's interview with Ananda Gupta, lead designer of that their game, XCOM Enemy Within. And, yeah, thanks for joining us this week, guys. Look forward to more regular podcasts throughout the end of the year, we hope. And, yeah, sorry for those of you who are listening to us on iTunes and whatnot. We're in the process of getting our RSS feed fixed. We made some, like, big back-end improvements to the site, to PCGamer.com. That are going to have, like, a lot of long-term benefits for us. But one of the short-term shortcomings of that is that our RSS kind of temporarily broke. But our RT folks are totally aware of that and have been, and I've been harassing them with a needle and a pickaxe and other implements. I don't know why I said needle.
A needle and a pickaxe. That sounds like a frightening set of torture utensils.
They had two choices for our duel with IT. It was a needle or a pickaxe.
I don't know why my mind leapt there, what it says about me. But yes, we're going to get that resolved. Thanks for listening, guys, and we'll see you again very soon. Goodbye.
Bye. Hi, everyone. This is Corey Banks, managing editor of PC Gamer, and I am here with Ananda Gupta, who is the lead designer of XCOM Enemy Within. Ananda, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Corey.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk to you about XCOM, about the process of making games. I'm sure you've seen our coverage here of XCOM Enemy Within. We're all wild fans. So
I'm glad you guys are enjoying it, and I'm really, it's been really gratifying to see the fan reaction to Enemy Within. I think people appreciate having a really big expansion pack to sort of enhance all the elements of the game.
Absolutely. So, I mean, tell us a little bit about how the process started. Obviously, Enemy Unknown came out last year to critical acclaim. How did the conversation start to add an expansion to it, and how did you get involved?
Well, I started working on the design of Enemy Within in July-ish of 2012. And, yeah, 2012, just getting my years straight here. And that's obviously a few months before Enemy Unknown came out. And I was obviously spending most of my time on finishing Enemy Unknown. But, you know, the line gets drawn, and eventually the designers have to stop meddling and let the engineers work on eliminating bugs from a stable feature set. And so July was not too much longer, you know, that July was not too much longer before Jake was going to, you know, kind of back off from the game as well. Mm-hmm. In July, it was clear that we wanted to do some post-release content. 2K wanted to experiment with a variety of approaches. So, you know, at Firaxis, of course, we're always biased towards doing these big expansion packs, since they've worked so well for Civ, and we think they really work well for strategy games. You know, 2K was taking an inclusive approach where they wanted to do smaller DLC as well as a big expansion, and that was fun to try. That was an interesting challenge to try to get all that lined up. And so in July, I was working on both the DLC plans for Operation Slingshot and on the expansion design. Mm-hmm. And with the expansion, we thought a lot about things that we wanted to add, things that we wanted to add but wait and see. For example, Meld was something that we added that I was pretty sure I wanted to add something like Meld into the expansion, where you have this goal in the tactical missions that has a time pressure element on it, and you have to, it's a little bit play style altering. But I wasn't completely convinced of the need to do something like Meld until after the Enemy Unknown was out.
And why was that?
We saw how optimal play was proceeding, where, I mean, optimal, you know, I hate, you know, optimal, of course, is always less important than what the play styles that people find fun, but we saw, you know, people would play very, very conservatively, and that was fine, because that was the problem that we were giving them, and people were, you know, they would advance their squad very carefully through maps, make absolutely sure that you don't reveal any new aliens with your last move, for example. Those are things, those are principles that guide good play in XCOM Enemy Unknown, and I didn't want that to be I didn't want to simply have exactly the same tactical paradigm in XCOM Enemy Within, and so that idea drove a lot of stuff in the expansion pack. It drove Meld, which provides you an incentive to not wait and move slower slowly through the map, because you've got to find these things before they self-destruct. Okay. Obviously, adding the Mech Trooper adds a new class, which doesn't use cover. Cover is, of course, very central to how combat worked in Enemy Unknown. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm giving you a soldier type that says, okay, well, now he doesn't use cover. And that's kind of a neat twist. And then also, you know, with the genetic modifications that, you know, some of them having to do with stealth and visibility, and some of them having to do with, you know, the muscle fiber density that lets you jump onto roofs, those are things that ideally give you a new spin on the map. So that's, you know, it's partly driven because we knew we wanted to do a lot of maps, mm-hmm. but we also knew that it was not going to be a complete map turnover. We knew that people playing Enemy Within would eventually start playing Enemy Unknown maps in the expansion again. And so, given that we were going to be presenting them with some of the same maps, how can we induce players to play those, to have a new experience on the same maps as before? Meld is one way. New soldier capabilities with movement that make parts of maps that were harder to access easier to access now, easier to take and turn into a tactical advantage. That's another way. And of course, the new enemies and the mech trooper who doesn't use cover. Those are all different twists on the same maps.
Sure. And it seemed like going back specifically to Meld, that like that's the first instance in Enemy Within where you start getting you start having to make more choices sooner, and those choices end up having, you know, longer lasting consequences. It's very easy if you play Enemy Within the same way you used to play Enemy Unknown, in a more conservative style, that you'll become resource constrained and not get to do some of the more, you know, powerful aspects like starting, you know, mech production or genetic modifications.
That's one of the fun things about working on an expansion, right? Is that players have a comfort zone, and I want, you know, we want to make sure that the comfort zone is tweaked and shoved around a little bit, but we're also not going to change how the game fundamentally plays.
Right. Okay. So in designing that, like, is that where, I mean, you've spoke a little bit about how you started developing the mech class and adding those genetic modifications, but like just starting with that resource, like where did you then go in the design process to start building these other units?
You mean like once we start with Meld, where did Meld take us with respect to like getting in?
Absolutely.
The new toys.
Yeah.
I think part of the reason was simply that I didn't want to, I knew there had to be a new resource because I didn't want players to feel. It goes back to what I was saying earlier, where I don't want to change how the game fundamentally plays, right? And so, if mechs and gene mods cost are denominated in resources that were in the original game, then that's going to cause a pretty distorting effect on how you play the rest of the game.
It would have been a little constraining, I think.
Yes, so it would have been hugely constraining, and I mean, we obviously mechs and gene mods do also cost money, so they are, you know, there is that constraint still there, but it's not only that; it's not a direct trade-off now between your next satellite and your next mech trooper, right? Having Meld lets us say, okay, there's this alternate progression path that's in the expansion that is linked to the rest of the resource game because they do cost money, but it's not completely encapsulated in it. And so this gives players sort of a little breathing room where it lets players trust the game more. This is something that I find really important in game design, which is, can players trust your game? You know, mm-hmm. You know, the Mark of the Ninja, which was one of my favorite games last year in 2012. Mark of the Ninja, you can trust them because this is this stealth game where you have a lot of precision movement, and they place the checkpoints pretty frequently. So you can say, okay, well, I'm gonna go ahead and try to ninja face roll this room, right? And if I get seen and killed, that's fine because I trust the game not to make me lose a huge amount of playtime, mm-hmm. right? And so similarly, in a strategy game where we give you this awesome new mech trooper, what I want is for players to be able to trust the game and say, oh, the game is not going to punish me for building this instead of something else. I don't have to sit here. I don't have to, you know, after I finish watching this cutscene and get all jazzed about this new cyber suit that I get to build, the thing that I don't want players to have to do at that point is to sit there and say, okay, now I'm going to have to do this intense calculation about, okay, this is how I normally play the game. Well, you know, I build a satellite at this time. I build a new uplink at this time. I excavate and I build alien containment now. Right. I want the trade-off between those things to be weak so that the player doesn't have to worry as much. And so then, and the player feels much less reluctance about going to the mech troopers.
It's so funny to hear you say that because I feel like in the two playthroughs that I've started, the first time I totally lost all of my guys, I did feel like I had to. It wasn't as much a matter of trust, but I had to make a decision, and going one way or the other was going to cost me. Like I had to hold back on satellite production because I wanted to move ahead with some of the other aspects.
Yeah, that was actually one of the reasons why we reduced the cost of satellites in Enemy Within, is that because we were going to charge some nominal credit cost for these new things, I said, okay, well, we're going to make satellites cheaper so that players can worry a little bit less. Now, are they going to worry not at all? No, as you point out. But I wanted the main tension to be, am I doing mechs or gene mods, right? How am I spending the new resource?
Sure.
Now that said, I mean, as you know, people's feedback said, oh yeah, people still worry a lot about satellites, and I'm like, well, that's fair enough.
Okay, you're supposed to. That's
because satellites are pretty important.
Right.
And you know, some people have alluded to that as perhaps one of the things they'd like. One of the things they wish were less emphasized in the strategy games. I mean, you know, I'm sympathetic to that, but that's something that, you know, in an expansion you kind of design around.
Sure, I get that. Tell me a little bit about how you balanced the genetic modifications versus the mech class, because the mech, I keep wanting to say mech warrior, but that's not right. The mech class is The mech class is a distinct new class, right? Whereas the genetic modifications are really, they play out more like bonuses to existing characters that you've already made investments in. Like, you're making a radical change with the mech soldiers.
Yeah, it's interesting because we definitely wanted them to be a breadth versus depth kind of trade-off, right? So if you're specializing in gene mods, then what you're doing is spreading the benefit of meld over the whole squad. And if you're going to do that, then it doesn't make sense to wipe out classes, you know, to have like a new genetic trooper class, right? Because you're unless you want the player to never use the old classes in the expansion, which is clearly not what we want either, right? Mm-hmm. So having the gene mods spread around the classes spread around as something that you could sort of augment your whole squad. That was something that said, okay, yeah, it goes on top of their existing abilities. And that's neat because that means that there can be interesting debates and analysis between players about which gene mods work best on which classes and how many gene mods is best to stick on one class and how thin should you spread, right? I mean, if you give a class, you know, if you give one soldier five gene mods and he dies, you know, that's a strategic decision that has consequences. Whereas with the mech trooper, because the mech trooper doesn't have cover, that heavily affects the ability design for the mech. And at that point, it made sense to make him his own class. We actually had this idea early on where the mech trooper was not a new class, where you could put any class into a mech and it would sort of morph their abilities accordingly. So you could have a sniper mech that... still had headshot and squad sight and all those things. Right. But for example, the low profile ability, which is the sniper's ability that causes partial cover to be treated as full, that would be morphed into something else.
Okay.
And we ended up throwing that system out because it was, I mean, it never even made it into code because it was very confusing, right? Okay, he's a sniper, but he doesn't have these sniper abilities. He has completely different abilities in some places, but in other places he has the same abilities, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also, the mech has sort of inherently higher visual sex appeal than the genetic modifications do. You know, one of the things we wrestled with for a long time...
Can't wait for the sexy mech calendar that we're going to see next year.
That's right. The mechs will always have, you know, the mechs have a real visual impact.
Right.
I mean, there's a reason why in the Enemy Within soldier lineups on all of our marketing materials, the mech is center stage, right? Center of the lineup.
Because they look badass. Yeah,
exactly. And so given that, it made more sense for the mech to be its own thing, its own class.
Right.
And have its own unique ability sets. And then that also let us say, okay, well then we can have the mech trooper's class abilities interface and I hate the word synergize, but you know, work well with the tactical subsystems on the mech, the flamethrower and the kinetic strike module and so forth.
Right.
And that really led to a much less confusing and more integrated package. The problem then was we had a much less confusing system once you get there, but then how do you get there, right? And so that required us, you know, so you have this augmentation process. You build a cybernetics lab, you convert a soldier into a mech trooper, that's one step, and then you build him or her a suit, that's another step, and then you're there. I was really worried that people would just be completely bewildered by the process of converting people into, you know, converting a soldier, augmenting a soldier into a mech trooper.
You were concerned there were too many steps to the process?
I was concerned that people would be confused about which step did what. I was concerned about all of it. I was concerned about that people would not understand that a mech suit can be upgraded which is, of course, unlike any other item in the game. You know, no other armor suit can be upgraded. And I was concerned that people wouldn't understand, even after a while, they wouldn't understand the trade-offs between, for example, augmenting a squad and augmenting a colonel. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, these are things that keep designers up late at night. And I am very happy that people seem to have figured it out without too much trouble. So.
At what point in the testing process did you become convinced that it would work okay? Or up to release, were you concerned that players would still be confused about the process?
Once we got the VO in, I think I was reasonably happy. And then once we kind of settled on this idea that we wouldn't let you build any suits until you have at least one mech trooper, mm-hmm. right? So because I was worried that, you know, if we let you build a suit but you don't have any mech troopers, then people will think anybody can wear a mech suit. And, why, you know, I built this suit, why can't I put it on my heavy? And then I was worried that, okay, so we make some, you know, so we'll make players augment a soldier first. But what happens if they forget to build a suit, right? What happens if they don't realize that they're not done?
Sure.
And so with, you know, there's some fairly heavy-handed VO from Dr. Shen and some fairly, I think, some good menu design, I mean, some reasonably good menu design, and we were able to get it to the point where I think people figured out that, okay, so I make this guy into a mech trooper, but he can't go into battle yet. He's got to have a suit. The fact that the suits are instant build, I think, is really helpful, because even if you got confused about it, it doesn't cost you very much. You're just like, oh, okay, I'm just going to build this suit real fast, and now I'm ready.
You don't need to wait even
if a mission pops up. So a mission pops up, and your mech trooper is standing there, and you can't go into battle because he's not wearing a suit, and you're like, oh, great, I can't put this guy into battle. Oh, I'll just back out. I'll go in, and I'll build a suit instantly, put it on, and we're ready to go. Right? Like,
sure.
Yeah, exactly. And so by designing the system to sort of be forgiving of any confusion you may have had during the process, I think it helped people stay engaged, and so I think they were able to figure it out pretty well.
Sure. I want to shift gears, and you know, there's a lot to even talk about just on the player side, but there were some significant changes that were made to the enemy side as well, with the aliens and the new Exalt faction.
That's a good segue point, because people don't understand how Exalt works in a lot of in some respects, right? Like, I think people figured out really well how mechs work and how the augmentation process works. I don't think people figured out very well how Exalt works.
Sure.
Which is something, that's something where you just kind of have to, you know, players, fans in a vacuum, when they talk on, you know, when they talk on forums, when they talk amongst themselves, they often, you know, they're like, well, why can't it work this way? Here's an idea for a way to change how the game works. Anything we do like that has to be taught, and teaching stuff is hard. And the more dramatic the change from the original game, the harder it is to teach.
Sure.
And you only have certain tools for teaching. I mean, obviously. So I mean, the best way to teach people stuff is to have them teach it to themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a tutorial sequence for teaching you how to use suppression.
Right.
Suppression is an ability. It's an active ability, and it shows up in your training tree and as a choice between it and Shredder Rocket. And so when your heavy dings that level, you know, dings that rank, you're like, well, oh, let me read about suppression. Let me read about Shredder Rocket. Let me think about those things. Okay, in so doing, you have just taught yourself about suppression. So I don't, you know, as designers, we don't have to do anything.
Sure. those are the best additions.
That's the best, right? That's the best. When I don't have to, you know, when we don't have to do anything, when we just say, the player is going to teach themselves this. And, you know, I mean, there's different. And so there, as a designer, your duty is to make sure that choice is as informed as possible. But players will then do the teaching themselves. StarCraft does a great job of this in Heart of the Swarm, where, you know, when you're deciding whether you spend your credits on this upgrade, it shows you a video of the upgrade in action, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And you're like, oh, that really makes it. You're like watching that video. Yeah, yeah. You know, this is great. The idea that that's a tutorial video in disguise, right? You know, the thing. You know, everybody, you know, who wants to skip tutorial videos, they're watching this very closely. Oh, that's how that works. Okay.
Right.
So that's the best. But sometimes you can't do that. And so obviously, then the next best thing to teach is to have some kind of heavily scripted tutorial where the player has to go through the steps that you are telling him or her to go through.
And then it feels like hand-holding.
It's hand-holding, it's tedious, it's dangerous. I mean, that's the stuff those kinds of scripted sequences are very, very buggy.
Sure.
You know, because if the player does anything that the scripting isn't expecting, then you have to, you know, then you're in red alert land.
And I suppose
not
you're
the
running
game,
in, you're,
just in general.
Sure.
Yeah.
You're running in the risk of teaching how to use an ability for only one specific scenario too. Whereas it feels like there are abilities in XCOM that, you know, can be applied in multiple ways differently, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you overteach an ability, like something like abilities, if you overteach those, then you will be potentially putting the player, you'll be biasing the player against creative uses of that ability because it won't occur to them to use it any way that was different than was presented in the tutorial. So,
sure.
Scripted sequences, like I would have loved to have done a scripted sequence when you first encounter Exalt on the strategy layer, just to like walk you through intel scans and how cell hiding and revealing works and the
right.
fact that they can't do ops if they're exposed, all that stuff. I would have loved to do that, but you know, that's the kind of thing where it's like I want to do other things too, and we're an expansion pack.
Sure.
So
I mean, and I want to step back a second from the design consequences there, and just even talk about like where the concept of Exalt came from. Like,
I have to
imagine that you started speaking about the narrative process there for Exalt pretty early on in the process.
You would actually be wrong about that.
Okay.
So what's interesting? So we definitely wanted to do covert ops. We definitely wanted to have this idea of covert operations. That really fits with the theme and with the sort of general thrust of the expansion. But the idea that I don't know if I've ever told this story in detail before, but the idea that we had was we were going to introduce this new enemy, this new alien enemy called the Venomorph.
Okay.
I think we showed a picture of the Venomorph at PAX, but we didn't talk about him at all. So the Venomorph is sort of a cousin of the Thin Man. And what the Venomorph can do is he has two forms, right? He has this sort of larval form where he occupies your body cavity, right? He infects you and occupies your body cavity. Then you become a pod person, right? At that
Wonderful.
Point, you're dead. What's that?
Wonderful.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're a pod person. You're dead. You're basically just this puppet that's being controlled by this alien inside you. But the alien is capable of bursting out of you into its combat form,
okay?
Which is this sort of creepy-looking reptilian alien. And the idea is that the Venomorph is the ultimate, is sort of the, you know, the Thin Men are the aliens' infiltration units on a large scale. The Venomorphs are kind of like elite Thin Men.
Sure.
Right? Because if they are inside somebody, they are indistinguishable from a human. Completely indistinguishable.
Okay.
And so the idea is we're going to have these covert ops maps where they're full of civilians. And there's no aliens on the map, right? And everything's fine. Everything seems hunky-dory, right? Everybody's kind of walking around, doing stuff, walking on the sidewalks, looking at TVs in the store, having a drink at the bar, right? And your squad arrives on site, and you are trying to get an informer out. Okay, there's some kind of informer. And you also... Now, some number of the civilians on the map are actually Venomorphs.
Right.
And what will happen, and so what happens is you have this time limit that you have to obey before the informer gets spooked and leaves. So you have to get the informer before a time limit expires. While you're finding the informer, you can also, like, zap civilians that you know to be Venomorphs. We wouldn't let you zap a non-Venomorph civilian. But but you can zap civilians that are, you know, with, like, a taser or something, and this causes them to sort of neutralize. But as soon as you recover the informer, all of the civilians who are currently who have not been zapped and are Venomorphs would burst, and then you're trying to frantically escort the civilian, the informer out while defending against the Venomorphs.
Sure.
So that was kind of the idea. And then when I heard the scoping numbers on that, I was like, wow, this is really tough. Like, it wasn't just a production problem either. It was a huge, I mean, there were just a lot of design problems, right? Like, first of all, what's an informer doing? Like, what is this informer? Is this informer like somebody who used to work for the aliens and no longer does?
Right.
Okay, so the aliens have people working for them? You know, I thought they had mind control. Why would they bother with that? What do Venomorphs look like? How does a Venomorph go from sort of person's chest cavity sized to Thin Man sized in the course of seconds? How... Yeah, well, I mean, but that kind of, so
yeah,
that has to be
it's a leap to make. And there's also,
yeah, like,
I would
leap.
I would imagine it changes the design. You hit a point where you're almost kind of running away from the aliens.
Yeah, there's that. There's I mean, right, like we'd have to have a really interesting gross particle spray on the person who's bursting in order to conceal the fact that this little alien has suddenly become this huge alien.
Sure.
Also, like the AI requirements for that, you know, having civilian behavior, you know, having a lot of civilian behavior, you know, all that stuff that I said, you know, people walking around, people having drinks, people browsing in stores. That's really hard.
Right.
that would have taken a long time. and then also, like, what's the end game of the Venomorphs? You know, how do you stop them? Can you stop them, or is this just something you have to constantly deal with?
Sure.
What's the reward for recovering an informer if there's no endgame of the Venomorphs, right? So this idea that I had, you know, this was something where, you know, after a lot of discussion with art and with engineering, and, you know, I was just like, yeah, this the core of the idea, I think, is still sound, but it's really just very shaky in a lot of ways.
Right.
And so, now luckily, this was something that we had come up with pretty early. And so we didn't have to scramble. We didn't have to scramble very much for this. But then we decided, you know what? What if we can win in a lot of ways here? Like, what if the enemy here is not a new alien, it's a human enemy, it's a new faction? Well, that's great, because that means we can add a lot of them, right? We can add a lot of new types of them, because we already have a lot of human enemies, or we have a lot of human models and animations and so forth. So we'll obviously add new ones, right? I mean, Exalt has a bunch of new animations on them. You know, we didn't want to just be, you know, we're not just going to clone stuff.
Yeah,
but
you're not fighting doppelgangers.
Right, exactly. But we thought, you know, and the more we thought about the idea of having a human enemy, then it made the rest of the covert ops idea just make so much more sense. Like, all those narrative difficulties that we were having so many problems with, those all just kind of started to become much less problematic.
Okay.
And so Exalt, and of course, the idea of introducing another enemy, a human enemy, made Enemy Within, it was an even stronger fit to the theme.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The idea that not every person on the Earth reacts to the alien invasion in a sort of heroic, let's defend the world kind of way. Some of them might have their own agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them might be looking to take advantage. And so, Exalt definitely came about as sort of, it was like Exalt was definitely the second pass through the covert ops system. But we were, but once we hit on it, once we got a good visual sense of it, it was a very easy internal sell. It was a very easy internal pivot.
Right. How did that affect at all the design for the new aliens that you included in the expansion as well? Or were those plans just set?
Those plans were basically set. The new Mectoid and the Seeker both filled, I think, important roles in tactical. The Mectoid, you know, the aliens needed a sort of heavy unit with a new counterplay mechanic, the new mind merge creating the Psy Shield. The aliens really needed that in the mid game, and then the aliens, I think, also needed a stealth unit. And so I was pretty set on scratching those two itches from the beginning. The only question was how.
Right.
And the Mectoid, you know, the Mectoid began life as the Mech Muton, you know, because we were like, oh, yeah, let's sort of cyber up the Mech, or cyber up the Muton. And it was like, well, the Mutons already kind of have power armor. It was really hard to tell the difference. Like, it was very at game camera level.
Beefy, I would imagine.
Yeah, they're already kind of beefy, you know, so it wasn't a big size or silhouette change, because they're already in power armor. They're already, yeah, and so it's like, well, let's go back to let's take a step back. Which alien, if you were to say, you know, okay, aliens, alien lineup, which of you wants a power suit?
the poor little sectoid's going to raise his hand.
Yeah. Yes, oh yes, he is. He's going to be waving his hand the hardest. So, that was kind of that. Once we came up with that, it's like, yep, that's definitely the revenge of the sectoid. All right.
Sure, that's awesome. You know, we've spoken a lot about Enemy Within in the past few days here in the office. You know, we we were talking about it pretty extensively in our the podcast that we recorded yesterday. And one of the things that keeps coming up is this idea of choices and consequences. What makes a great strategy game is having an interesting choice that you have to make, you know, as often as possible, and then dealing with the consequences from that. And
yep.
It's fascinating that you were put on this project and you've added, you know, in our opinion, so many more of these choices. I don't know if a lot of our podcast audience is aware, but you're also the designer of a great board game that's really about having lots of interesting choices, and it's called Twilight Struggle. Is it fair to assume that, like, your experience of working on this Cold War, I don't want to say simulator, but certainly Cold War strategy game in the tabletop space affected a lot of the design decisions you wanted to put into Enemy Within?
Well, it certainly drove some of the creative decisions. I mean, I'm a huge spy fanatic, right? I love spy stories and spy films, and so the idea and Cold War history, of course, and so the idea of having covert operations and a sort of cloak and dagger aspect to the whole expansion was definitely something I pushed very hard, and thankfully the team had faith and bought into what I was trying to push there. But I think designing board games, designing board games, I think, has a couple of lessons for electronic game design. And one of those is that, you know, in board games, of course, you don't have no computer to lean on to enforce the rules. The players have to enforce the rules themselves, and for that reason, the things like the rules underlying decisions have to be very clearly messaged to the players. And it's, you have to avoid using the computer as a crutch for that. You know, in order for the decisions to be interesting, the players have to understand the trade-offs, and there have to be, you know, it's one of the things about Twilight Struggle is, you know, the first time people play Twilight Struggle is a card-driven game,
right,
where you have a board and you have a, you know, board position and so forth, but the events of the game are driven by cards that the players draw and can play in a variety of ways. And people who have played the game Twilight Struggle many times, they know the whole deck, right? They know every single event in the deck. Mm-hmm. And they know, you know, so when they pick up their cards, they're like, okay, well, I drew these cards, but I know these other cards are either coming up or in my opponent's hand.
They know how all the events are going to relate to one another.
Yes,
they've
exactly.
That shorthand, yeah.
Yes, and so I think having a game, you know, with Twilight Struggle, I think we were very fortunate to hit that really hard, because you want a game that's really compelling the first time you play it, as well as the 100th time you play it, and having decisions that have both an obvious upfront trade-off interest and, you know, an interesting decision. That's important to make people interested in playing a second, third, fourth time. Mm-hmm. To keep them interested on the 100th play, players understand, they really understand the guts of it, and they really understand how everything works together.
Right.
And so having that depth, I think, is very crucial. And that's something that that was impressed upon me heavily, you know, in my board game experience. The other thing I think, and this is maybe a little bit nitpicky, but I think in board games, I think there's this weird tendency in video games to give these sort of optimal paths where, you know, I have a soldier who's pretty good at X, Y, and Z, but he's really, really, really good at A, right? Mm-hmm. And so the allegedly interesting decision there is, oh, you should have him do A.
Right.
Right. And so players feel a little bit smart because they read his description, they read his background, they read his abilities, and they're like, okay, clearly he should do A. I'm going to make him do A. But what's more interesting is the soldier who's good at everything. Right.
And you have to decide what to have him do in that moment, and he's going to be okay at it.
Right. Yeah. Right. If he can do everything, then you're deciding what is more important to be, you know, that I have this guy on. Who do I put my star player on?
Right.
You know, what do I put my star on versus what job do I have, you know, do I settle for the bench warmer on, right? And so, and there's a little bit of that in XCOM. This is something where, you know, there's a little bit of that in XCOM for sure, where mechs are good at a lot of different things. And gene mods, but you can build a whole squad of gene modded soldiers to sort of balance out their capabilities, right? This, I think this is an interesting sort of long term personnel decision. And you know, with board games, I mean, you have to be very careful about trying to translate board game mechanics over it. So I try not to do that very often. I've been burned on that before. But,
sure.
I think with XCOM and with Twilight, I think with Twilight Struggle, the idea of always, I mean, the feeling that the Twilight Struggle captures in people, at least they say, they tell me that it captures, is this idea of constant crisis management. Mm-hmm. You know, you're looking at your cards, and your cards are posing this enormous problem for you to solve, and you're just thinking, you know, I'm always gratified by people who tell me about their first Twilight Struggle game, and they say, every turn I thought I was on the brink of defeat. And then
that's
after the game,
it's a good game, yeah.
And then after the game, my opponent said he felt precisely the same way.
Right.
Right. So if you have a game where both players feel like they're constantly on the brink of defeat, to me that captures the Cold War pretty well.
Right.
And
there's a large component of that in XCOM Enemy Within, especially in the early game too, where it feels like everything is escalating so quickly that you're kind of on the precipice. It feels in the end game you get to a point where you're powerful enough that maybe you can take on the challenges if you're just playing normal Iron Man mode, like Care Bear mode, like me. But definitely, like that concept of crisis management, I feel translates really well to XCOM.
I think the emotional state of crisis management is a great, great state to bring in games. And I think, I mean, there are lots of games that do it in various ways, you know. Like horror games do that, you know. If you're playing Dead Space, I mean, and you're looking at your ammo, and you're like, well, I guess I got to go to the next room, you know. I mean, that's crisis management right there. I think, and then there are games that sort of fake crisis management, if you know what I mean.
I do.
I'm reminded of a particular Call of Duty video where you have to put a breaching charge on this door, but if you don't, nothing happens.
Mm-hmm.
You just get the VO to put, you know, breach the door now.
Or like
okay,
how many times
now,
a game
right?
will tell you that you know it's you have to go to this quest giver person immediately, or you know something bad will happen, but you can obviously take your time and do whatever you want. Like that's such a bad issue with like open world games as well.
Right. Yes. And games with allegedly, you know, with sort of very robust, persistent worlds where you can't let people grief the world.
Sure.
whereas, you know, in PvP, you know, in sort of in Twilight Struggle, which of course is a two-player game, one against one, and in XCOM, where it's a straight up, it's you and it's your world to save or fail to save. We have the freedom to design stuff like that. I mean, I worked on MMOs before, so I've grappled with those problems of how do you design a world where people you want people to feel like they have an effect on the world, but you can't actually let them have an effect on the world because you don't want them to use these powers for evil. If you
sure.
see what I mean.
Absolutely.
I think you know with XCOM, people sometimes ask why in Enemy Within we increased the freneticness of the early game, right? The early game in XCOM Enemy Unknown was perfect, so why change it? Well, it gets back to what I was saying about your comfort zone, right? Players developed a comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we change the dimensions, change the boundaries of that comfort zone without fundamentally changing how you play? And in Enemy Within, the answer came partly through Exalt, partly through offering new content like Operation Progeny. That is optional. You know, you can shut off Operation Progeny, and that you know that will certainly remove the pressure on you some.
Right.
You know, you can shut off Operation Slingshot. That will, you know, that will also dial down the pressure on you some. But people don't seem to want to do that, and that's fine. You know, because I think they like it. I think even people who say, you know, why are you increasing the pace of the game? The answer, you know, when the other game's pace was already so good, it's like, well. It was really good.
Ratchet it up a little bit, and people seem to be responding well to it.
Yes, exactly. And so, yeah, and so that was why. Like, you can't in an expansion pack. You have three things, right? You can try to improve things that were weak points in the original game, which you know we tried to do. We tried to do that primarily on the user experience side. You know, adding scan lines, making some inventory management easier, so forth. and improving some game balance stuff on the abilities. That's, you know, that's one thing. You can try to add brand new awesome toys that can go on the cover of the box and then make people and then drive people crazy with anticipation and then, you know, deliver in the game with great fun experiences, you know, and here I'm thinking about punching things. And then the third thing is you can look at things that the game does really well. And this is arguably the hardest thing, right? Because everybody has their laundry list of pet peeves about the game that you released that you want to improve, that you want to touch again, right? You know, there's the old saying, this is an old saying from board games, which is that games are never finished, they're merely shipped.
Right, right.
You know, everybody has that. Everybody can. You know, everybody's brimming over with ideas for how to for awesome brand new things to add. And so the question is, okay, do you want to make sure that it's all integrated with the right theme? You want to make sure it all works together, and you want to make sure that it will, in fact, cause fans to go crazy. And then, but the hardest one is what is good about your game that you should nonetheless tweak in order to get players who played the base game to really sharpen their edge.
Right. To become better players.
Yes. And I think that's, I think we were able to hit all three of those in Enemy Within, so I'm really proud of that. I think the team is justifiably very proud of that.
Excellent. Excellent. So, I mean, it's kind of an unfair question to say here at the end, but, like, I mean, what do you think is next for XCOM?
Well, obviously, you know, we're very pleased with the critical reception to Enemy Within, and as far as I know, 2K is as well. So I think the future of XCOM is promising. What exactly it entails, I can't say. But sure.
Can we expect? Is it a scenario where we would expect more smaller scale DLC stuff along the lines of Slingshot, or big meatier content, or potentially both?
I would. I don't think. I certainly think that the, you know, that we have sort of what's the word I'm looking for? We have definitely recommitted ourselves to the larger expansions.
Okay.
Right. So I really like that. But I certainly can't say whether, you know, there's going to be another because I actually have no idea.
No, I understand that. Well, I mean, the big expansion in this case, Enemy Within, I think is phenomenal, and I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.